Hi, good evening or good morning or whenever anybody is watching this, whatever time of day. So thanks for joining me. I have something really interesting to chat about today. I have with me Professor Paul Townend from the University of North Carolina, Wilmington.
That's right.
That's it. So Paul is the author of, let me get the title exactly right, Father Matthew, Temperance and Irish Identity. And we're going to talk about a subject which I think most people in Ireland like have about as much knowledge as I have, which is we have a vague knowledge of Father Matthew and how big the Temperance Society, and that used to tie in with Daniel O'Connell and big mass meetings. But I think probably that's as much as most people in Ireland know, and probably no one outside of Ireland has a notion of any of this. So I think it'll come as a surprise to a lot of people, because I mean, Paul, you can address this as well, but I mean, there is the caricature of the drunken Irish. You know, it's it is a caricature that's out there. I've always put it down to, you know, it's colonial attitudes to native peoples everywhere. They're seen as kind of irrational, and they're unable to control themselves. And of course, but there's an element of truth comes in, because when you're colonized, you have no future, you have no hope, and then that does lead people to drink. So it becomes kind of a self-perpetuating thing, I suppose. And I'm wondering, maybe if we start there, like, what was the situation in Ireland in the early 19th century? And was there any truth to this whole image of everybody being drunk all the time?
I was the way you do when you start in a PhD, trying to find the right thing to write about, and I kept finding in the history books a sentence, you know, or two, that would say this crazy thing happened for a few years and everybody in the country stopped drinking, and then and then they started again, and Father Matthew was in the middle of it somewhere, and there's a statue here and there, and you know, and I kept looking at that and thinking. Some people had written about it, so I don't want to overdo the being the first, you know, but it struck me as, right, you got that stereotype, you have that connection, and I think you're absolutely right, it goes back not just to the history of drinking, which is, it's super hard to know who was drinking more than who, you know. I think the thing between the English and the Irish was whatever about amounts, they drank very differently culturally. I think a lot more differently back, you know, say in the 19th century and earlier than they do today, you know, right. Although even today they drink differently. So that difference took a lot of forms, but probably most dramatically, right, was what? I mean, they were drinking whiskey. And if you think about, and that as a practice in Ireland goes way, way back, you know, to certainly, you know, the 10th and 11th centuries, that's what we know the Irish people were drinking, whatever they were drinking before that.
Right.
And spirit drinking is not really part of, you know, especially 18th century and earlier English culture. So when the English looked at the Irish, and they usually looked at them through the lens of, yeah, the whole colonization enterprise, they saw people who drank differently, right? They drank, what they drank was different, how they drank was different. You know, drinking in public and drinking in public gatherings and drinking out of doors was all kind of part of how drinking happened in Ireland. For a long, long time going back, you know, so it was, I always tell my students, Irish people back then drank a lot like college students. They drank together in big packs on, you know, occasions. They weren't kind of sitting quietly in their houses or in a little pub somewhere like you might today, having a quiet pint. It was social, and it was occasional, and it was sort of, you know, binge drinking really is, you know, I guess technically what was going on. So I think the norms were just different. And I think they, for the English, that definitely got translated into a stereotype that goes way back of, you know, the Irish drink this crazy liquor, and they're, you know, we always see them doing it. And it just became, I think, it's really interesting how stereotypes develop, you know. Now, how much truth was there to the amount thing is really interesting. You know, it gets easier to track in the 19th century because they're taxing the whiskey production. A lot of it's happening, you know, in the hills and illegally, but even that, you can count how many people are arrested for, you know, as you move into the 19th century for making illegal stuff. And you can see something happening at the start of the 19th century and the back end of the 18th, which looks like a rise in consumption.
Okay.
So one of the things that's going on that sort of sparks, I think it's one of the things that sparks the Father Matthew thing, is Irish people's own sense of two things. Like, one is that we're seen from the outside, and they were very conscious of that stereotype, and you can see this in all the sources, as heavy drinkers. You know, it's sort of the national vice, right?
Okay.
So terms like that, you know, and so they're very aware of the stereotype. You know, they have their own opinions about how true it is. And then on the other hand, you know, there's something going on with consumption in the early 19th, late 18th century. Probably has to do with population increase, because most of the population is increasing super dramatically, yep. Like the fastest rate of population increase really anywhere in the world at that point in time. That's potatoes and the rest of it. But as that's happening, you know, if you think about it, if it's a society that's built around occasional drinking, you know, what were the occasions? And they were baptisms, and they were weddings, and they were funerals, and they were, you know, that's the kind of drinking pattern everybody describes. So think about it, right? I mean, the communities are just growing, and this very traditional kind of practice all of a sudden is accelerating. So you find really interesting stories in you know, observers of all of this about, you know, the lengths people would go to, right? Very poor. The lengths people would go to raise the money to get the whiskey together for the next thing, whatever the thing was, right? So I think there's a way in which, just from a lot of different angles, drinking probably was increasing. And I think also the awareness of Irish people themselves, both of the stereotype and one of the things, you know, as I was writing about Father Matthew and trying to explain why, right? Why do you go suddenly from a lot of drinking to almost none? And it really is pretty sudden what happens. Fascinating kind of story about mass meetings, but the mass meetings happen by accident, right? They start having little meetings and people keep coming.
Okay.
So there's definitely a kind of a something happening in the society around their relationship to alcohol.
Okay. You know? Yeah, because it's interesting what you're saying there. Like, just what you're describing is not really, maybe not alcohol related, but like, we still have this thing where we've convinced, I think most countries convinced, or at least people power, that, you know, there is something, some really bad relationship to alcohol that is unique in some way. So that's still an image that people are worried about even today. And there's also what you're saying there about, you know, if you have gatherings, you have things, and you're trying to get, you're putting forward your face that you can't be the person to go in without anything. In that case, it's whiskey, but like, you always have to put on this face that you're not doing as badly maybe as you really are, you know?
Yeah, there was a big communal dimension to it. I guess that's not really surprising, but it did put pressure on people in all kinds of different ways. And of course, you know, we know a little bit more about how this works now. If you happen to be predisposed to having a drink problem and you're living in that kind of an environment, it can, you know, there's more alcohol more often and more sort of just an expectation. And so this was one of the things that the temperance reformers jumped on, right? The fact that there was, in a lot of cases, pressure on people to drink, and they wanted to create a kind of a counter pressure.
Okay.
And, you know, that was very much sort of the game of Father Matthew and these kinds of reformers. He's really part of a movement, but he's a particularly interesting and successful version of the movement, right?
Yeah. So
go ahead.
Let's get to Father Matthew. Just one second. I just want to put this again in place. So, but there were temperance movements going on around the rest of Europe as well. It wasn't like this wasn't a standalone thing that was purely Irish.
Yeah. And in fact, it was a thing that was struggling to find a foothold in Ireland, you know, and the religious divide was sort of part of why that was such a challenge, right? You had organized temperance, the crazy idea that people should just not drink at all. Right, it is very new, and it's really an American idea. It kind of comes out of, you know, the Great Awakenings and American evangelical culture as it develops, and you start to get these little temperance societies, and you know, that's only really, but Father Matthew gets going around 1838, but these societies in America really are from the 1810s forward, and they catch on, you know, and they're brought. Sometimes literally brought, some ships that were going back and forth would operate on temperance principles once the movement got going. So, you know, none of the sailors were allowed to drink, and it was a weird thing. And people thought this was the strangest idea they'd ever heard, right?
Okay.
John Francis McGuire, who is a friend of Father Matthew's and a disciple, is the guy who founded the, and now it's the Irish Examiner, but it was the Cork Examiner for many years, right? And the Cork Examiner began as the Cork Total Abstainer. It was the newspaper of the Father Matthew movement for a while. But John Francis McGuire was one of the early kind of converts, and he writes about the early movement. And I nearly called the book this, but it was too long and the editors wouldn't let me. But he describes temperance as it's initially kind of brought into Ireland by these evangelical types who are trying to convince the Irish to stop drinking, a form of social eccentricity very near to madness. That was McGuire's description of how Irish people thought about this idea when it first was sort of proposed to him. You know, it was initially first proposed to him mostly by Protestants. And so, you know, and in Cork, there were a number of kind of ecumenically minded, Unitarian, socially active kind of clergy, but also merchants, some of them Quakers, who thought this was a great idea and it would be the solution, you know, for all the Irish problems. And they thought it was the solution for problems in other places too. But when they looked at Ireland, they thought, well, if we could just sober the place up, you know, the next thing that would happen is people would take all that money and they would do better things with it. And, you know, there was a whole ideology around this being really the key to unlocking social progress. But nobody wanted to do it and they couldn't sell it as an idea. And at one point, the Archbishop of Dublin sort of comments that, you know, the people are not going to, he's asked about what he thinks about this. This is about a decade before Matthew. And he says, you know, the people are not going to take seriously an idea that comes to them from people, however well-intentioned, who they don't see as having their best interests at heart. Right. So this idea from the outside, that really wasn't a Catholic movement in any kind of way, shape, or form. It was a movement in sort of Protestant evangelical circles that starts to catch on, you know, especially in the United States, then in some parts of England and in the north of Ireland as well. There, you start to get some successful sort of Presbyterian, you know, temperance societies in Belfast, a guy called John Edgar and some others who, you know, they start to think, well, you know, the right way to get this idea to take off is to have messengers who kind of, you know, are religiously aligned. You know, they were people who thought, well, you know, maybe they should be Protestant instead of Catholic, but maybe if we get them sober first, we can start working on the other problems after everybody's done drinking. So, but Father Matthew was a very progressive kind of guy in a lot of ways, and he was friendly with some of these reformers, and I think they sort of targeted him. He was. One of the things he was best known for was working with the poor, and you know, the Botanic Garden Cemetery, if you know it in Cork, was his project. You know, a way to sort of deal with the problem of Catholic paupers. There were issues with burying them in Church of Ireland graveyards, and it was a running issue. Father Matthew, who had some private means but also knew people, sort of raised money and bought the Botanic Gardens and turned it into like a pauper's. Other people were buried there too, but. So he was very engaged. There was a cholera epidemic in Cork in the 30s, and he was one of the people who, you know, were willing to stay with people as they were dying from that super contagious disease. So he had a great reputation as, you know, being, and he had a little friary in Cove Street down by the Keys in Cork, and he was really connected to, I guess, what we would call kind of social justice type ministry. And they knew that, and he was friendly with some of these people who got interested in temperance, and I think they talked him into it. You know,
right? So, I suppose this is the first thing where I don't. It's come kind of as not history that I learned. It's like he was not. It was not his driving force. It wasn't him doing it. It was definitely someone coming to him because he had the connections.
And that's right. Yeah, and he was. You know, he was super popular. This is back in the day, right? So he was very, very benevolent confessor. He was famous for not giving too harsh a penance, and people would flock to him for confession. He was a Capuchin, so he was sort of outside the normal clerical apparatus a little bit of an outsider in a lot of ways. He came from kind of a wealthy family too, so and it was one of these landowning families, the Matthews, and I think they're in Thomastown and Tipperary, who were kind of half Catholic, half Protestant, depending on which person in the family was inheriting the farmland, right? And so he grew up in this sort of different environment from a lot of people, and he was very sociable, like kind of famously friendly and gregarious, and he got thrown out of Maynooth for having a party in his room. As he became a Capuchin friar because they wouldn't, you know, they kicked him out of Maynooth for a party, and I'm sure the party involved drinking. So, and the Matthews too were kind of famous. They show up a little bit, I think, in some of the, you know, the generation or two before in some of Swift's writings about the sort of the degeneracy of the Irish landed aristocracy because they're big drinkers. And so he came out of this more cosmopolitan, more ecumenical, more broad-minded kind of, and he was at heart this very generous, very sociable, very likable guy by all accounts. You know, his big thing was charity sermons. He was employed kind of all over the country, even before the temperance thing, to sort of show up and give a sermon on behalf of the poor and raise some money that would, you know, incidentally be used also to build churches or whatever else they needed money for. So he was a good speaker, you know, you wouldn't want to overdo the charisma side of it. Like, I think he was just a friendly, quiet, likable guy who had a great reputation.
Okay.
He cashed it in with temperance, I think. They convinced him, right, that the best way to help the poor would be to endorse this movement. And he did, you know.
Yeah. So what you're saying is, like, I mean, he probably hadn't occurred to him effectively before, but once they talked to him, he became a believer. He thought this could change things.
Yeah, and I think he was actually probably, from what I can tell in some of the early, you know, back and forth, and there's some good accounts of the very early movement that survived in a little early Dublin. I found this in my researches, hadn't been looked at in a while, that gave some good accounts. Matthew had a secretary who was really interested in promoting the movement eventually and wrote an early history, but also was regularly writing to the newspapers and trying to drum up business for the movement. But so we have some pretty good insight into the early movement. And he's supposed to have said, you know, including the speech, right, that he gave at the first meeting. And he I don't think he expected the kind of success that he experienced. He just thought, you know, I think initially he swore himself off drinking for a year.
Okay.
As an experiment. And then he kind of went public with a couple of meetings, and the meetings started to fill up, and there were hundreds, right? And they had to move them to a bigger venue. And then people started coming kind of from the surrounding countryside to Cork. And, you know, part of the ritual that a lot of people did early in the movement too was they would have a farewell to whiskey. So they would get gloriously drunk for, you know, a day or two or three, I don't know, however much they could afford. And they're sort of leaving this trail of destruction probably in their wake as they came to Cork, and they turn up in Father Matthew's living room literally in the middle of the night, you know, often drunk, you know, and they would take the pledge. And I think eventually the idea of, I better take the show on the road or they'll throw me out of Cork. There were issues. He had to get permission from bishops, and people had different ideas about whether or not this movement was a great idea, you know, in the hierarchy and in the clergy and in other places too. But you know, he did have supporters. And I think the first time he kind of left Cork, he went to, I want to get this right, because there's a meeting in Limerick and a meeting in Waterford. I can't remember the order they happened in. But he did them very close on their heels after about a year of people coming to Cork. And they were they blew people's minds. Like, if you read the newspaper accounts, they have no idea how to describe what happened. But people are actually killed in the crush at one of them. And they have to call out the militia and the dragoons to kind of try to keep order. And there's, you know, crowd estimates are kind of hard for that period, but people are saying there's hundreds of thousands of people at these meetings. That may be an exaggeration, but it was unbelievable, the response. And it just turned into this thing where he's, you know, for the next couple of years, he kind of just did a circuit around the country, and everywhere he went, you know, crowds of tens of thousands of people, and they had to organize them into batches, and they would come in front of, he'd give a speech and probably most of people couldn't even hear it. And then they'd get organized into batches and they'd go in, and the pledge is quite short, and they would take this pledge to abstain from alcohol for life. And then he would make the sign of the cross over them, and then they'd bring in another batch, and it was like a conveyor belt. And, you know, my guess is, you know, it's again hard to tell exactly, but even taking into account that they were exaggerating their numbers, lots of people who didn't like the movement were exaggerating the numbers too. So everybody said this was, it looks like probably at least half the adult population, you know?
Yeah, that's kind of the figure I heard as well somewhere. But yeah, like, I mean, I guess it's worth repeating that. Like, I mean, half the adults in the country pledged.
Hard to imagine, you know, and it, you know, it also, it wasn't just the half that took it. If you kept drinking, you got very quiet about it. So, you know, probably public drinking, which was how people drank, ended, you know, across much of the country. And there are lots of accounts, some of them are in the book, of, you know, crowds of temperance activists finding people drinking and throwing them into rivers. And so there's this counter pressure in a lot of areas, or all of the, you know, young women of a given region writing a little letter to Father Matthew and saying they've all vowed not to marry anybody who isn't a teetotaler. And you know, they're forming these temperance societies and clubs and reading rooms and bands. And there's this big change in kind of not just who's drinking and who's not, which is one thing, but how people gathered and socialized. And so it gets very interesting for the, you know, for a number of years while the movement's kind of taken over the country in a lot of ways. You get people who, you know, would travel the countryside for the first time after the movement who knew it from before. Travelers' accounts are great. You know, people who kind of, you know, were there in the 30s and then came back in the early 40s and say this was complete transformation. So, all my research kind of showed me this was, at least for a time period, very genuine and very dramatic and very transformative. And if you think about drinking as a, you know, not just something you do in your spare time, especially back then, but something people spent most of their disposable income on, something that all of social life was kind of more or less organized around, it was a big, dramatic, you know, transformative development. Nobody knew what to make of it. Father Matthew didn't either.
Yeah, because from what you're saying, like, I mean, it's not something that, like, the way, again, just the way I learned, you know, he was the figure and he kind of almost imposed it on the country. But it sounds like he was just kind of sucked up into something that the people wanted.
Really clear from the sources. You know, I mean, he himself was kind of sucked up into it in a lot of ways. And I think a lot of other people were as well, don't get me wrong. But we tend to think, right, temperance is this. Some elites have some ideas about social control and they show up and they convince, you know, they make laws, right? There's no laws about any of this. There's no legislation passed in Ireland. The government's annoyed because the bulk of their revenue came from whiskey taxes and the revenue drops off a cliff. I mean, in the early 19th century, that's where governments made their money, you know, commodities taxes, and there's no income tax. And there's a little bit of a land tax, but not much of one. The money came from, they needed people to drink, right? The whole cost of whiskey was the tax, essentially, right? So there's a big crisis in a lot of ways for the state, but also, you know, the government doesn't know what to make of it. They suspect it's the beginnings of some kind of revolutionary conspiracy that, you know, and there were some historical antecedents for that, right? Like the 1798 business supposedly was preceded by, you know, the people stopping drinking in some places. It was, you know, so there's this association with, in the minds of the authorities anyway, of not drinking actually with rebellion and trouble. So
yeah, I suppose it is like, you know, keep them drunk and they're not going to get anywhere, you know.
And that's the rhetoric of the movement too, you know, so I don't want to just make it sound like an accident. They were very actively promoting a certain understanding of what they were doing. And it wasn't just Matthew. It was, you know, people like his secretary and John Francis McGuire, who's, you know, becomes a politician right after he's a journalist. And they're telling a story, you know, the Nation newspaper, right, which is just getting its start right in the middle. I think the temperance movement is an inspiration for those guys. Charles Gavin Duffy, who's one of the early editors, and Tom Davis and the rest of them are all fascinated by the movement and inspired by it. Duffy organized all the teetotalers in Newry before he became one of the editors of the Nation. So they're all caught up in both the politics of, you know, repeal and Daniel O'Connell, but also temperance. And they see the two things as speaking to each other. And they definitely see the temperance movement as, you know, a refutation of the stereotype that the English have of the Irish, a thumb in the eye of the authorities in a lot of ways. The revenue is spoken about a lot at these meetings, you know, like, won't they be surprised when they won't know what to do with us. So I think that the patriotism and doing this for, you know, the good of the country and the rest of it was very much in the forefront of what the movement, how the movement presented itself. I think it was, to me, it was the best explanation for why the thing took off, because it really filled this sense, I think, the Irish people had of, you were talking about the, you know, the colonial realities, right? Like, I don't think people are intellectualizing all of that, but I think they did see themselves as disempowered, as despised in a lot of ways, is looked down on, and they understood the alcohol thing to be part of the justification that was being used, you know, in terms of the power relationships and the rest of it. So I think, yeah, it's a early temperance. Later temperance is different, you know, which gets more into laws and top down. But early temperance in the early 19th century is very bottom up. It's very populist. It has its own kind of energy that I think people like Matthew just kind of didn't know what to do with, you know.
But do you think that was there from the beginning? Because like you're saying, you know, a year or two in, there was this big national thing. But at the very start, he was still having meetings with hundreds of people. Like, were they?
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think there is some difference between the beginnings of the movement when they're kind of, you know, they're doing what by then is a kind of a standard thing. You offer a space for like a club for people who don't want to drink and want some support in that. You provide a pledge, you provide a little medal, you know, you encourage people to kind of do the right thing for their families and for their, you know, and I think that message was, you know, had some appeal to especially upwardly mobile kind of, you know, kind of people. But that's not what happened really in Ireland when, you know, there's no other temperance movement like this where, you know, masses of peasants kind of show up and do a thing. And I think that it's really interesting to think about how much of that was, you know, a kind of an external set of ideas, right? Temperance as a sort of a system in the way I was describing it comes very much from America, but I think something changes with it in Ireland. And I think, you know, again, they're scrambling afterwards to try to understand that and then to harness it, you know, and people like Daniel O'Connell and other politicians immediately kind of start to see that there's something going on here with, you know, the people's sense of their relationship to the rest of the world. They really wanted to stick their thumb in the eye of the stereotype, whatever else they were doing.
Right. Because that is obviously the other thing that they're always linked together is temperance and Daniel O'Connell. And the fact, as it was always represented to me anyways, that Daniel O'Connell's meetings could never have happened unless temperance had happened kind of a couple of years beforehand, you know, that.
Yeah, I think that's what he said, you know, and I think if you track, you know, I track this pretty closely in the book because I was very interested in the political dimensions of it. But yeah, I think that he himself, you know, he's interesting because a lot of his political support traditionally, you know, over the decade or so before all of this had come from, you know, alcohol distilling and brewing and spirit grocers and the people who sort of were the alcohol trade were very Catholic. That was a kind of a big chunk of the Catholic middle class were involved in the alcohol trade in one way or another. He sets one of his sons up as a brewer, you know, in the years right before the temperance movement hits. And O'Connell himself was, you know, was a drinker. You know, he was, I don't think, you know, interesting to think about how much, and he always knew when to stop, unlike some people. But he, you know, he was very convivial and hearty himself, and these big dinners and lots of toasts, and that was part of his thing. So I don't think he was initially, right, you know, interested in a thing like this, but he immediately, and you can see the wheels turning as he, and a lot of his wheels turning happens in public because he'd be making speeches and he'll start to talk about what's going on with temperance, and this is showing the whole world who the Irish people really are capable of being, and isn't it interesting? And then, you know, eventually he takes the pledge himself, you know, but he takes it kind of privately, and he actually gives it up privately about a year later, but he pretends, you know, he wants to associate temperance with his movement, and he especially wants to associate Father Matthew. Okay. Father Matthew is trying to avoid, you know, any direct political connections, so there's about a year when O'Connell's sort of chasing Matthew around the country, trying to show up in the same place as him. And eventually, you know, they're doing something in Cork, and they can't say no to O'Connell after Matthew set up a big parade, and O'Connell comes, and, you know, he appropriates the movement in a lot of ways that are really interesting. And all this is in the run up to, right, the big repeal year of 1843 with the monster meetings and the big mass gatherings. He's very much, I think, inspired in that direction by what's happening in temperance, and the crowd sizes are kind of similar, you know, the temperance bands and the temperance societies keep order at these meetings, and people show up sober, which was not the case for mass gatherings in Ireland a decade before. So that, you know, I think that change in the culture definitely gets leveraged, you know, for political advantage.
Yeah, because maybe just in case anybody ends up watching this who doesn't know, Daniel O'Connell was one of the biggest figures in Europe, basically, but he led this repeal movement, the union between Ireland and England, and it was always non-violent, and it was like you said, mass, hundreds of thousands.
He's really one of the pioneers of kind of, you know, mass democratic action,
yeah.
You know, and sort of, look, what did you have in Ireland? You could get, you didn't have economic power. In a lot of cases, these people, depending on when we're talking about, didn't even have the right to vote, right? You know, but you could leverage mass movements. And O'Connell sort of is really one of the great pioneers in really all of kind of the Western democratic tradition of that kind of popular pressure.
Yeah.
You know, and so he's a really interesting character, but I think, you know, there's also something about Ireland and popular movements and mass culture that transcend even the temperance thing, you know.
Is there, like we're saying, so there was like these two groups then going on having mass meetings. What point did they, or did they kind of converge? Because like you said, there was the temperance were marshalling a lot of O'Connell's meetings. So were they, did they all become just one movement at the end? Or?
Yeah, I think a lot of that played out on the local level. So if you spend time in Father Matthew's correspondence has survived. So, you know, the captions have it and I've been through it, you know, and as the movement grows and becomes more politicized, you see Father Matthew, you know, writing letters to local societies, telling them to not show up at political meetings and to try to avoid, you know, linking the two causes. But I think, you know, as somebody put it, it was the same people.
Yeah.
You know, if O'Connell gathered 100,000 people for repeal, they were all teetotalers more or less by the time we get to the, you know, 1842, 43. Matthew starts in 1838 and the movement is up to speed by 1841, 42. And that coincidentally, right, is when O'Connell launches his thing.
Yeah.
After the Cork event. So O'Connell very adroitly kind of, I think, in fact, during 1843, the year when O'Connell really gets the huge mass gatherings going, Matthew leaves the country because he's afraid and because he doesn't want the movement to get associated with this sort of illegal political movement that might be heading towards revolution. So he goes to England and he spends, you know, most of the summer that O'Connell's organizing everybody in England, trying to kind of make a separate case for temperance and also trying to promote temperance among the, you know, the many, many Irish people who were scattered or already there in London and in the industrial cities. So he does a tour in England and the whole tour he's going to the English journalists. Don't think they're the same movement. They're not. I don't know what O'Connell's doing over there. It's not my thing. I'm against any sectarian politics. Or that was the other thing, you know, for Matthew, the movement had to be, he really wanted to build a kind of a common ground.
Okay.
So he was very interested in, you know, in Protestants joining the society. He was very interested in making a point that it was a space where people with different political ideas could kind of come together around the cause. That wasn't always practically how it played out, but that was his vision. And you know, I think he kind of loses control of the movement a little bit.
So he wasn't at all, from what you're saying, like the whole, he didn't care if there was a union or not. He didn't, that wasn't what he was interested in.
His own politics are kind of hard to suss out, you know, but I think he was deliberately, you know, kind of cautious about that kind of thing, especially once the movement got going. Right. So, you know, and he had friends sort of across the normal religious and political boundaries. So he, you know, that was a big part of who he was. So he's an interesting character in a lot of ways politically. I think he was a patriot. So he very much sells the movement as great for Ireland. In fact, you know, he gets in a little bit of trouble in Rome and about, you know, there's some issues with temperance as a Catholic movement. You know, the church had decided various things about alcohol. And one of them was you couldn't say alcohol was bad. You know, it was a created good. And so, you know, you communion wine and everything else. Temperance was really theologically problematic, actually, for Catholics. But, you know, Matthew made the case sort of up the command chain in the church that the situation in Ireland was different and that, you know, the Irish had such a national problem with drink that, you know, he writes sort of to Rome and says, you know, you in Italy can't really understand the disaster that alcohol has sort of created in Irish culture. So I'm not advocating for temperance as an idea everywhere, but I think it's very important for the sake of the poor in Ireland that we promote it. And, you know, he sort of tried that kind of an argument, which some people bought and other people didn't.
Right. And then he went off to America as well, didn't he? For
yeah, he did. You know, he was in Ireland through the famine. There was always a sort of a plan for him to tour Ireland. I think mostly the idea was to talk to Irish emigrants and to sort of promote temperance for the emigre community. But it, you know, for one reason or another, it didn't happen. And then, you know, the famine hit and he got very caught up in, which had bad consequences for the movement in Ireland. It kind of broke the movement in a lot of ways, although it was breaking probably before the famine, to be honest. But the famine was a disaster for temperance. And temperance probably saved a lot of lives in Ireland in the sense that it was the temperate people who had just that little bit of money laid aside. So when I think when the crops failed and you had year after year of bad harvests, it was the people who had a little bit of money squirreled away who could find a way to swing passage and get out. So I suspect that, you know, a big percentage of that famine era migration was the temperance movement that kind of created that opportunity. But he did come to America after the famine. By that point, he'd already had, you know, his health wasn't great. And I think he spent a lot of time in America touring, promoting the movement, trying to raise money. You know, he was always trying to raise money for the sake of the movement. And also, he was also personally financially distressed. He gave all his money away, whatever money he had in the movement. And he gave medals away and he incurred debt. And, you know, there were people who thought he was profiting off of it, but the opposite was pretty much true. So they actually have to organize a national, you know, tribute for him right before the famine to try to bail him out of some of the worst of his debts. So the America thing was part of that, you know, that tradition of raising your money in America and then coming back to Ireland and trying to spend it on the right things. But, you know, you had some issues in America too, because the movement got caught up there in anti-slavery politics.
Yeah, that was, I read that from your, some summary of your book, which I had no knowledge of, but he knew Frederick Douglass, who'd taken the pledge in Ireland, if I understand.
Yeah, right. Frederick Douglass was fascinated by Father Matthew. So, you know, when Douglass comes to Ireland, he's determined to England. He's determined to go to Ireland, I think largely to see Father Matthew. He goes to Cork and he meets him. And there's some really interesting, you know, Douglass writes to his own newspaper about that journey and about that meeting. So, and I think the meeting of those two figures was, there were a lot of drawings of it and people imagined the two of them talking together and they got on very well. So there's a whole interesting kind of, Americans were fascinated by what was happening in Ireland because it, in a lot of ways, it was the dream of temperance activists in America to have this level of success. So they weren't quite sure what to do with Father Matthew because a lot of them were evangelical Protestants who had a lot of, Frederick Douglass among them, wasn't at all sure what he made of Catholics in general. And, you know, Father Matthew maybe was an exception. But I think that was part of the problem in America too. It was the association of the anti-slavery cause with the temperance cause, which was very strong in America. And Father Matthew always wanted to keep the temperance cause in its own little bucket, you know. And a lot of the Irish emigrants in America, of course, weren't big supporters of abolitionism. So you got into all the politics of slavery and the politics of freedom and the politics of drinking were all intertwined and it was a big challenge there too.
And that would have been like, this is the time, you said it was after the famine. So probably most, or at least by that stage, a significant portion of the Irish people in America were famine refugees that come over on the coffin ships and that.
Yeah. And temperance was on the one hand, you know, part of their, at that point, you know, part of the culture they were coming out of, but they were struggling really. It didn't translate very well, right? Because temperance activists in America tended to not be friendly to the Irish, you know, so it kind of created this dissonance a little bit. And I think Matthew was trying to repair that and trying to keep the movement. You know, really, it's part of that whole phenomena of the Irish becoming really a very global people in that era.
Right.
But, you know, whenever you do that, you're living in different political circumstances. So I think that some things translate better than others. And temperance struggled, you know, with Irish Americans.
but it's interesting that it did, because like you said, these were the people who had taken the pledge in Ireland, the majority of them, and now they're in America. And you'd assume, at least I would assume, you know, you band together, and therefore your culture and what you've just been has just been your culture and that you've been very proud of would have kind of been the defining factor or something. That's
maybe if he'd had a little longer too, if the movement had had a few more years of strength, you know, I think the question for people who sort of think about why this movement as a rise and fall story, right? Why did it rise? I think it rose because of, you know, the Irish sense of disempowerment, their own relationship to alcohol getting more complicated, and somebody offering, you know, a way forward, you know, that was very patriotic and very kind of inspiring in a lot of ways. So the rise is interesting. The fall, you know, tends to get blamed on either the famine, but yeah. Most of the evidence I have sort of shows the movement was already weakening pretty dramatically, you know, even before the famine hit. So I think the fall has a lot more to do with the association with politics. You know, O'Connell's very successful in co-opting the movement, but then his political movement collapses, right? So okay. He's imprisoned and the movement loses a lot of steam. And I think people who sort of saw the temperance cause and the repeal cause as leading to, in the short run, right, to this glorious kind of new transformed Ireland are very disappointed by 1843, 44. And I think, you know, they drowned their sorrows.
if you see them combined, then it's shattered. It's like
it's interesting.
Both sides of it goes.
How ideas get associated in people's minds. But you know, the rhetoric, the kind of appeal, the patriotic nature of the temperance movement got wrapped up in the patriotic nature of the repeal movement, and I think they both ran out of gas in association with each other. You know.
Right. Right. No, that's
I don't know. You know, people. The other thing is that, again, drinking had a long history in Ireland, a lot of, you know, connections to society, too. And it was part of how the culture operated. So I think a lot of people struggled in this new temperate kind of climate to figure out how to do community. You know,
okay. Yeah,
because you know, we know a drink helps for sociability. And I think they found new ways on the one hand. But on the other hand, you know, the old ways still had appeal.
Right, yeah, and still do.
They do, yeah. I'm not a teetotaler myself, so I understand the appeal.
Yeah, but I mean, all this took place, so like you're saying, in about the span of about 5 or 6 years, basically.
Yeah, it's a whirlwind, and you know, it's amazing. One of the things besides the drinking and the not drinking side to it is how much it showed me, you know, that a society can change on a dime. You know, it wasn't exactly on a dime, and you could see the reasons why, you know, but who knows why a thing takes off, you know,
yeah.
Why an idea kind of all of a sudden goes from being a thing to almost everybody. I do think there's a tradition in Ireland before Matthew, you know, O'Connell's part of it, but it's continued post Matthew of, you know, collective reinvention is actually kind of an Irish tradition. And
yeah.
I think you can point to different turning points and wonder about why, but you know, it's not the first or the last time that the Irish people all of a sudden sort of point themselves in a very new direction. It's happening now, you know, it's happened in this generation in Ireland. So,
yeah.
You know, I think we know what a social transformation looks like, you know?
Yeah. And I suppose after the fact, it's very hard to pinpoint because it is a mishmash of so many different things coming in together and just happening.
Why we have historians, you know, why historians have a job anyway. You know, somebody has to look at this and pretend that it's easy to explain.
Pretend it makes sense. You
know, that's the thing about the Matthew movement for me. One of the things that fascinated me was, okay, it happened and you can track that and you can see the numbers and then you have to explain why.
Yeah.
And I have my own ideas about that as you're researching and writing, but you know, I was fascinated by how they explained it. Because,
okay.
You know, it was so obvious that something had transformed. And so they sat down and they sort of scratched their heads. And, you know, so I organized kind of their ideas about why the transformation had happened into different buckets. You know, there was a crowd of people, mostly, you know, English or Protestant, who sort of said, well, it's just another example of the superstitious kind of herd instinct of the Irish. This is what they do, you know, or maybe they're plotting a rebellion, you know. But then there were, you know, voices from inside the community that said differently, right? That, well, you know, for Father Matthew, the answer was pretty simple. He thought it was providential. You know, he said, this is as clear an example as you're ever going to find of God moving. in a society, and, you know, the Holy Spirit and the rest of it. Like, this was, to him, you know, it was so obviously divinely inspired. You know, there's no other way he could explain Irish people suddenly stopped drinking. So that was sort of his part of his argument upwards to the church, where he's saying, you know, look, I know there's maybe some theological questions about this, and what happens to you if you break a temperance vow? Do you go to hell? Is that a sin? I don't know. And you know, those kinds of conversations definitely took place, but his position on it was always very clear. It was, look, this is very clearly the finger of God moving, you know. But then there was another take. John Francis McGuire would be a good example of this. It was like, look, this is the people rationally responding to the very difficult social circumstances, a rational recognition that alcohol had become a problem in the society, and a rational decision to kind of improve the country. You know, so for somebody like McGuire, and I think maybe for O'Connell too, the movement made the connection between temperance and repeal was very clear, and it was the collective kind of patriotism and wisdom of the people to try to improve their circumstances.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think the contemporary explanations are good, and they're fun to kick around.
Yeah. No, it's a fascinating story, and like I said, I mean, they went from possibly total complete country full of alcoholics to nobody. To nobody drinking, to a famine, but the whole temperance thing has never quite died out either. I mean, it still has its echoes, I suppose.
It had a half-life in Ireland for sure, you know. I mean, not just the statues, and, you know, I guess you got the Father Matthew Tower there, and I can't remember whether it's Little Island or Big Island outside of Cork, but, you know, there's a Matthew statue in Dublin too. So there's that, you know, which I think is the bit of it that Irish people today kind of, oh yeah, something happened. There's the statue and the movement. But the, you know, the idea of like what had happened, I think, stayed with a lot of people. And I think, you know, that's why you got such a successful, you know, reinvention of the movement at the end of the 19th century with James Cullen, who was a Jesuit who started the Pioneers. And the Pioneers in a lot of ways had a lot more staying power than Matthews. So into the 20th century, and I know they're still active today too in a lot of ways, but that Pioneer movement was massive, especially in the early Free State.
Yeah.
You know, part of the apparatus, the, you know, police and army, and was institutionally, and Pioneer was, my mother grew up in Cork, and she certainly, you know, he would do that confirmation pledge thing, and that kind of practice was associated with Pioneers. Had a really different perspective on what they were doing. You know, they really saw the Pioneer movement as a kind of an elite, you know, a moral elite who were going to kind of bear the sins of everybody else's drinking in one kind of way or another, which is admirable, you know, but it's a heavy lift sometimes. Yeah. You know, the Matthew movement was more like everybody should be in it, then we all should stop and we should do it together. And the Pioneers had a different ethic, although I think they were very interested in having as many members as possible.
Yeah.
It was always seen as a thing that, and this is part of how you thread the theological needle. You say, well, it's not so much that a drink is a bad thing, but not drinking for the sake of, right, the sins of people who do drink is a noble undertaking.
So
you know, we fast, you know, not because food is bad. We fast because, you know, it's spiritually uplifting.
Yeah. No, and that is, like you said, completely different from Father Matthew's one. Like, these, it sounds like it was a big party, but just not drink. Like, it sounds
That was the challenge for the movement, how to make it feel like a party without a drink. You know, if you've ever been to a very sober party, you know that can take some effort, you know. But they made the effort, you know. They tried to Matthew was very big on this, like, replacing, what do you replace all of that cultural space that alcohol took up? How do you replace that? And you know, the answers from the movement were really clear. It was reading rooms. You know, we increase reading, you know, we have, you know, that practice and that pursuit. So temperance societies would club together their money and that they might have spent on drink, and they would take in newspapers and books, and they would, you know, rent some rooms. And so they did a lot of that. And bands, you know, like these temperance bands were a big, big deal.
Right.
And a lot of the, you know, the local kind of energy that might have been caught up in faction fighting or drinking and then having little rumbles, the attempt anyway was to sort of move it in that direction. The movement published books of poetry and temperance songs for people to sing. Those are great fun, you know, just go through all the old temperance ballads. And they tried to harness, you know, all of that sociability that I suppose – Irish are still famous for, you know, in this different kind of way, and with varying degrees of success. A lot of pubs got converted into, you know, tea shops, you know. So like Bewley's, you know, you Bewley's founded when, right? 1842. Yeah. And by Quakers for sure, but it was an attempt to capitalize on, you know, all of these newly sober people who needed something to drink.
Yeah, I needed somewhere to go. Just to... No, it like I said, it's a fascinating story, and it's one that, yes, you know, even around it survived, and we know the history some bit, but I mean, nothing like. I think we know that it converted huge numbers of people, but no one, I think, knows really the full story. We link it; it's linked so much with Daniel O'Connell, really, that has almost kind of taken over the presentation of it, you know.
The bottom-up version of the story, which really is the only way to explain what happened, is a lot more interesting than the top-down version, and I think it gets a little bit more at, you know, I that's why I titled the book Irish Identity, because I think what was going on was, you know, people were trying to figure out who they were. The language is disappearing right in this generation.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of really interesting things going on with Catholicism where, you know, the church was not the later 19th century church. It was a very different kind of popular Catholicism. There weren't enough priests or enough churches even to sort of, so the relationship of the Irish people even to that part of their identity, you know, which gets stronger over the course of the 19th century, was still kind of in flux.
Yeah.
And yet other things too, you know, like the population increase had disrupted families, you know, and it parents had lost a lot of control over their children. And, you know, any idiot, you know, with a quarter acre of ground could grow enough potatoes to feed himself and his family and didn't have to listen to his parents. So, you know, you kind of, marriage ages are dropping and the language is going away and people are beginning to emigrate in large numbers even before the famine. And so, like, the society is in a bit of an identity crisis, you know, in the 1830s and 40s. And I think, for a period, temperance became kind of part of the answer to the question, you know, which was still is getting asked all the time, right? What does it mean to be Irish? What does it mean to be Irish in Ireland today? You know, it's a very different question from, you know, say whenever my mother was growing up in Cork in the 1950s, or, you know, so it's a change is kind of a constant in Irish history, but this is a, we don't always think of it that way, right? A traditional society, but what does that mean?
Yeah, no, it is. It's like I said, it raises huge numbers of questions if you want to dig into it. So, but I guess one of the more interesting is like, if it had stuck that extra, maybe if the famine hadn't come, if Daniel O'Connell
had held off
a bit, or if he'd been successful, if it had kind of, if temperance had dug its heels in for like another 10 years, what the country would have been like. It's one of those counterfactuals.
Yeah, I think it's natural to say, well, it wasn't going to last, obviously, right? You know, like who would, but you know, the truth is it lasted for years, you know, and people really, I mean, by all accounts kept, not everybody all the time, but the pledge was generally kept. There was a lot of social pressure for it to keep. And there was the beginnings of the development of a new kind of future. I don't know what that would have looked like exactly. And, you know, another thing about it that was interesting to me was the persistence of the stereotype. It didn't seem to matter what the Irish were doing. They were still perceived from the outside as drinkers. Maybe they needed longer to shake off the stereotype, but they were well on their way.
Yeah. I'm even just thinking, like, off the top of my head, you know, there's been a lot of, like you said, emigration into Ireland over the last 20 years. I think it's like, you know, huge percentage of the population, but it's been done without too much kind of, you know, conflict, though there's a little bit kind of creeping in now, but I've always put that down a lot to the pub, you know, it's where people mix and you find out that the other people are actually people and not a, not a group either, you know, and so, if that hadn't been around, would that have been as accepting? You know, it's always.
Yeah, you know, I think it's another thing. The story of the movement is provides some evidence for is, yeah, the need for, you know, a social center of gravity for a community. You know, and the you know, the truth is they didn't really have the pub yet. There are pubs, you know, especially in cities, but again, most of that drinking is just happening in tents and you know, so the pub kind of is. A lot of things going on with pubs. They're a space you can control and you know, and it's a different way of drinking. So I think there's a reason too why the pub was a more popular way of arranging your drinking life after Father Matthew than it had been before. I think people's attitudes about drinking changed in some ways, you know, even though the movement ended.
Right. Fascinating stuff. I'll let you go because I'm sure it's still afternoon there. You've probably tons to do. But yeah, listen, thanks a million for taking the time. It's really been fascinating. It's a fascinating story.
My pleasure. I love talking about it, you know. So thanks for having me.
All right. Well, listen, if I find anything to talk to you about again, I'll give you a call.
Anytime. All the best.
All right. Thanks a million, Paul. All right, I let it go and